Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, molecular Velcro, the world of fungi and why some are so deadly, 3D electron microscopy, and hangover-preventing nanoparticles. Administered to mice, they sobered up the animals far faster than the controls. Could they work, though, in us? The Chemistry World podcast is sponsored by Waters, world leaders in innovative analytical science solutions. Visit waters.com for more information.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and with us for this, the April 2013 edition of Chemistry World, are Phil Broadwith and Neil Withers, and Patrick Walters, who's up first with a look at things that can stick, even underwater.
So South Korean scientists have developed a supramolecular Velcro that you can use underwater, so it can be stuck on and stuck off nice and easily. So Kim On Kim from Pohang University produced this supramolecular Velcro by attaching some ferrocenes to one surface and some cucurbit urals to another surface.
You better explain, first of all, what those two chemicals are. But before you do, why is it supramolecular? What does that mean?
You're relying on the shapes of the molecules. They're kind of structures rather than specific bonds within them.
I see. So what are the shapes of the two bits that you mentioned? What are those chemicals?
Right. So the ferrocenes can be compared. It's a bit like Velcro. So you can compare the ferrocenes to the hooks on Velcro, whereas the loops on Velcro would be the cucurbit urals.
So if I could zoom in with a really powerful microscope, what would they actually look like, these two chemicals?
I like to compare it to a load of hula hoops stuck to a surface, so those round circular crisps, and then on
What molecule are they?
So these are the cucurbit urals, these kind of circular molecules, and on the other end, the kind of hooks of the Velcro, these would be the ferrocenes. In the diagram, if you look at them, they look a bit like, say, something like Smarties. So something sort of fairly small and spherical that would just sit straight into those hula hoops. And then the hydrophobic interactions and the ion-dipole interactions, that's what would hold them together and hold them together with great force.
And underwater as well.
And underwater. So
what sort of force does it take, or will this thing take?
They created a 1 centimeter square patch of this, and they tested it underwater, and it could hold two kilograms of weight. So this is just one very small square, and if you take it out of water, it could actually hold 4 kilograms. And by comparison, Velcro would only take about 200 grams. So it's obviously it's a lot better, a lot stronger.
The great virtue of Velcro is that you can peel it off and put it back down again. Does this stuff work the same way?
Yeah, it does work the same way. So you can use mechanical force to pull it apart, but obviously you're going to need to put in quite a lot of force to pull it apart. It's not like Velcro that will come apart nice and easily. They also have another way of separating it at the moment, which is chemically. So they can use bleach. So this actually oxidizes the ferrocenes, the Smarties, if you like, that are sitting in the hula hoops, and then this weakens the attraction between them and the cucurbitals, the hooks or the hula hoops.
Not terribly good on environmental grounds, though.
No.
I wouldn't have thought you'd put bleach into the sea if you're using this thing in a marine environment.
Exactly.
To get it to separate.
But they are thinking for underwater it might be possible to use an electrical field, but they haven't tested this yet. So that would be perfect for underwater if they could get that to work.
Is it practical to make?
It's not too bad. The cucurbitals are quite expensive at the moment, so that's the sticking point, really. If you go to bulk, large-scale production, maybe the price will come down a bit. At the moment, they're still quite a niche molecule.
And Neil, sticking with the watery world, ultramarine.
Scientists in the UK have recreated an old lost recipe for the ancient pigment ultramarine.
I didn't realise there was a recipe. I thought that we made this using minerals that were already out there.
Well, originally, back in the ancient times, lapis lazuli was used to create ultramarine, and it was incredibly expensive, which is why blue was used for paintings of the Virgin Mary and such things as you might see in museums. But in the 19th century, a French society offered a prize for someone who could come up with a synthetic route to it that would be much cheaper. And unfortunately, this recipe has been lost, because I guess people didn't keep as good records as they do now. People didn't publish their work as much. And also people were more secretive because this was a lucrative thing. You know, this was hundreds of francs per kilo. So people wanted to keep their trade secrets close together.
And unfortunately, that recipe has evaporated into the mists of time.
It has, although there are clues in other recipes that weren't quite as good and recipes that maybe, you know, went halfway but didn't quite work. So what Ian Hamilton at the University of Surrey did was look at all these different fragments of recipes and recipes that were maybe not as scientific as we'd see now, where they said heat until cherry red, for instance, which isn't that much help. And they tried a lot of different recipes and little variations on them until they could find one that made something as good as the ultramarine that you see now.
Have they published their recipe? Or is it still a secret that's going to disappear?
It's not a secret. Fortunately, in today's more open world, they've even published it in PLOS One. So it's
open
free,
access. Even.
Open access, yeah. So that's the difference between now and the 19th century.
So what is the recipe? What's special about it?
So I think the recipe is controlling the amount of air that gets in when you've heated the pigment after you've done a sort of a first round. You make something that's more like the mineral, the lapis lazuli. And then you have to do a sort of secondary heating and make sure that not as much air gets in as perhaps you might think. And I think you have to heat it to 500 degrees C for 2 hours with a little extra sulphur and not too much air, just the right amount.
So what are the key ingredients to put in there to get that beautiful blue?
So you start with kaolin, China clay, a bit of sodium carbonate, some bitumen emulsion, although they say any sticky carbon source is available, so perhaps you could just use black treacle, and sulphur. And you heat that up to 750 degrees in a furnace, which would probably be cherry red. And then you let a little bit of air in, then you cool it, grind up your sample, press it into a pellet to get all the bits of solid to react a bit better, and heat it again to 500 degrees with a little bit of extra sulphur for 2 hours.
So can we now look forward to lots of regal, expensive-looking, blue-coloured stuff,
well, of course,
but dirt cheap?
Well, it's been cheap since the 19th century, and there have been other things that have superseded it, like Prussian blue and international blue and lots of other blue pigments. This is more just a curiosity and a bit of sort of forensic chemistry / art history.
Now, Withers, also often intensely colourful are fungi. But why? And what do they do in the soil?
My name's Geoffrey Kibbe, and I'm a mycologist, which means I study mushrooms and fungi and everything to do with that subject. Certainly all of my adult life and quite a lot of my sort of childhood was spent studying fungi.
If you're anything like me then, Geoffrey, you must hold a sort of morbid fascination for these things, because not only are they beautiful, but some of them are deadly and some are delicious.
Absolutely. And, of course, some of them look extremely unusual. They've got vivid colours or strange shapes. Some of them are sticky and slimy. Some of them are scaly. So that they look unlike, I think, anything else that we come across in the sort of natural world. We're used to flowers and plants. But mushrooms, because they often have a very limited season and they're quite a short while, of unknowns. And then the added sort of cachet that some of them can be extremely toxic or deadly.
Why is that? Why is there that incredible overkill, but only in some of them?
The best answer is that no one actually knows. It's what we do know is that it's not aimed at us. It's not aimed at mammals because the effects are not immediate in most cases. They take many hours or even days to kill you. So by the time the mammal's eaten the fungus and goes away and then dies, it's not going to be on to pass that information on. Most likely, the toxins are aimed at tiny things like nematode worms and insects that feed on the fungi. And some of them may have no particular target at all, but just be byproducts.
What actually happens to them? Why do they get unwell, and what's the time course? You mentioned it's quite long.
It depends on the particular mushroom. Some will have very rapid effects. Within an hour of eating, you may feel nauseous, you may feel sweaty, you may start getting palpitations. It has to be stressed, the vast majority of poisonous mushrooms probably won't kill you. They'll just make you extremely sick. You may wish you were dead, but they won't actually kill you. And some of them will hospitalise you, but not necessarily be lethal. The really poisonous ones are limited to a small handful of species in this country, at least. But some of the less toxic ones, the effects will be quite fast. Certainly within an hour, you may be vomiting or something. Others may take several hours. And in the case of the really serious toxins, it can be 4 to 6 to 8 hours before you start having some symptoms.
Are all mammals affected similarly? In other words, can mice eat a mushroom but we couldn't, or something? Or
absolutely. Just to take an example, the most sort of infamous deadly mushroom is in this country is the death cap, a species called Amanita phalloides, which will one cap will kill a healthy adult without treatment. But rabbits can eat death cap. Their stomachs appear to be able to neutralize the toxins. Whereas, interestingly, if it's injected into their bloodstream, it will kill them, just the same as it does us.
So what fraction, if I take a woodland walk and I survey all the beautiful fungi that are cropping up along my walk, what fraction of them, were I to eat them, would be bad for me? And what fraction probably are actually edible?
A very small percentage would be poisonous. Vast majority of mushrooms, I would think, well over 80%, are either tasteless, in meaning they're edible but they don't particularly taste nice, or they're tough or they're leathery. Some of them, of course, are very good edibles, quite a lot. But there is this small percentage, maybe 5 to 10%, maybe less, which can give you upset stomach, ranging all the way to serious illness to possible death. So it's quite a small percentage. It's important not to sort of panic and think that every mushroom out there is going to kill you. It certainly won't. The problem is you've got to learn them individually.
The ones that are bad to eat, are they nonetheless extremely good in the soil? Do they do a very important job of distributing nutrients and making and synthesising important things?
All fungi are essential part of the ecology of the world around us.
I mean, I learned about the concept of the fungal switchboard a few years ago, and I was intrigued by the idea that you've got this dense network underground that can cart nutrients from one area where there might be something growing which is putting something into the soil and enriching it in that area, and
Absolutely.
Then take those nutrients to an area where there's a relative paucity of something and enable things to grow there that otherwise wouldn't, were it not for this network under the soil carting
exactly.
the nutrients along.
And most woodland trees depend on fungi to grow. They have this intimate relationship. The roots of the tree are wrapped around and penetrated by the fungal threads, which we call the mycelium. It wraps itself around the tree, penetrates the cells, and then there's this complicated relationship where they're swapping sugars and carbons and so on backwards and forwards. And trees which are deprived of their fungal associates actually grow very poorly. If you grow them in culture minus their fungus, they do very poorly indeed.
And if fungi have this very dense collecting area under the soil where they are picking up things in the soil, although they may themselves not be bad for you, could they therefore collect things from the soil and bioaccumulate them, like leads or heavy metals and so on?
We know that lots of mushrooms are quite good at absorbing heavy metals, for example. If you remember when we had the big atomic incident at Chernobyl, pretty much the whole of northern Europe, certainly through Scandinavia and even parts of Scotland, for quite a few years after Chernobyl, we were advised not to eat the mushrooms because they'd absorbed quite a lot of radiation, partly directly but also from the soil. And some fungi are deliberately cultivated with a view to actually absorbing these heavy metals and various other toxins so that they can clean up waste sites, for example. We know they're very efficient at cleaning up things that would otherwise be very difficult to extract from the soil and would otherwise remain in the soil for many years if you didn't treat them with some of these fungi that we're now discovering are extremely good at mopping up, as it were, and helping us in that respect. So there's a whole sort of industry out there being developed on this front.
Geoffrey Kibbe, you're listening to Chemistry World, sponsored by Waters, with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, a new way to see crystals and molecules in unprecedented detail, an E-nose for brandy, and, appropriately enough, hangover-busting enzyme nanoparticles. But first, Chemistry World listeners will have heard us speak in the past of DNA origami, and even using DNA as a form of data storage to look after the works of Shakespeare. But now life's recipe book is being investigated in a very different way. As a flame retardant. Patrick.
So scientists have managed to develop a greener, cleaner flame retardant using herring sperm, oddly enough. So Giulio Malicelli from the Polytechnic of Turin has extracted DNA from herring sperm and then used it to treat cotton. And cotton treated with this DNA is then resistant to flame. It actually doesn't burn at all well. Now, Why is this? Why is DNA a good flame retardant? Well, flame retardants need to have certain properties. And one of these is that they need plenty of carbon compounds in them because this produces char, and char acts as an insulator. It doesn't burn, so it helps to prevent the fire getting out of hand. It helps to protect the material from further heat. But there's also some other properties that a good flame retardant should have. So if they produce an acid, great. That's also good for things like fibres, like cellulose, cotton cellulose, because this dehydrates the fibre. Then you have more carbon compounds that can go to char. And there's one other little extra that DNA also has. It can release non-combustible gases. So if you burn it, you can get things like ammonia coming out because of all the nitrogen compounds in the bases.
And that will obviously suppress the fire. Is it practical, though, to use DNA? I mean, that there must be a lot of happy herring in this particular experiment, I would think. Yeah. But that's obviously going to produce a DNA-coated piece of cotton, which is all very nice for that piece of cotton. But what about if you wanted a lab coat or something, you know, something practical, or a Bunsen burner mat or something?
Well, they have already managed to successfully coat cotton and prevent it from catching fire. But the problem is, at the moment, DNA is pretty expensive, but Malicelli doesn't think it might be that much of a problem to get the price of DNA down, because why is DNA so expensive at the moment? People want high purity, they want sequence. A load of junk DNA just extracted willy-nilly from herring sperm.
Indeed, but could we use the same sort of chemistry? So DNA is revealing to them that it's a good flame retardant, but we could probably borrow the chemistry. Do we actually need DNA, or could we just put something together that's a bit like it, but much cheaper?
It's possible we could put something together like it, but I wonder if we could get it any cheaper. DNA has this great phosphate backbone all the way down. This changes to phosphonic acid when it's burnt, so there's your acid that can dehydrate the cellulose. It's also got a good carbon source in the form of the sugars and also the bases and the nitrogen in the bases as well. So you could come up with something synthetic, but why bother when you could just extract it from vegetables or leftovers from fish? There's so many possible sources.
I shall, in the meantime, while they work on that one, stick to my more traditional flame retardant fire blanket I have in my kitchen, of course. Phil, tell us about PCBs and a good way to recycle them.
Yes, well, this is a more environmentally friendly way of recycling all of the circuit boards from the increasing number of electronic items that we're throwing away every day. What Ping Zhu and colleagues at Zhejiang Gongsheng University in Hangzhou have done is look at a way that we can get rid of all of the acid and base that's commonly used to try and sort of dissolve these circuit boards down, and try and use something that's a little bit more recyclable.
I see. So talk us through actually how we do recycle printed circuit boards, PCBs, at the moment, and then we can look at how they've tried to improve on it.
OK, well, there are a variety of ways, depending on the kind of setting. You may have seen on various documentaries that there are almost cottage industries of people kind of picking out these waste PCBs and getting the precious metals out of them on the roadside almost. But there are also more official programs to do it, and they generally use hydrometallurgy. So that's either using a strong acid or a strong base to dissolve the different components or break down the resins that that hold the different layers of the printed circuit boards together. But that generates a lot of acid or salt waste that can't be regenerated in any way. So what this Chinese group has done is replace the aqueous, the acid or base layer, with a solvent called dimethyl sulfoxide, which is something that lab chemists will be probably quite familiar with.
DMSO.
Yeah, DMSO.
It's also regarded as relatively safe. I mean, we use this when we give stem cells to people. We use it as a cryoprotectant to freeze cells, and then we thaw them out and give them to people. So it's not very, very unsafe compared with a lot of those other chemicals you were mentioning earlier.
Yes, it's relatively non-toxic, which, you know, for the people doing this kind of stuff is obviously a bonus.
How does it work?
Okay, so normally a printed circuit board, you have layers of different plastic bonded together with normally a brominated epoxy resin. And what the team did is clip off all of the soldered on components, which they can then take off separately, break up the boards into fragments a couple of centimetres squared, put them into the DMSO and heat it up to about 60, 80 degrees under a nitrogen atmosphere, and that swells the resin between the different layers. So it kind of gets in and prises those layers apart. That leaves you a load of sort of solid flakes of plastic that you can take out and recycle in a fairly normal way, and then you've got the resin in the DMSO. You can evaporate the DMSO off the sort of resin residue and then reuse that for the next batch. You lose about 2%
You evaporate the DMSO, then you recondense it and use it back in the process again, losing a little bit, okay, admittedly a little bit, but then you're left with the solid chunks of resin that you can then dispose of safely.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we see countries like China start to crack down on their environmental emissions and that kind of thing and waste regulation, then this is the kind of thing that I think we'll see a lot more of.
But lots of countries have been exporting their rubbish and their recyclables to China, partly because rules in Western countries precluded a lot of the use of the sorts of chemicals that you were describing being used, and it was therefore cost-effective to send them to China. But the sort of process you're describing is going to be very cheap and could actually happen in many Western countries, and you wouldn't have to ship these things abroad.
Well, yes, I mean, that would ultimately be the hope. If we can stop wasting resources by shipping all of this waste, you know, halfway around the world, then, you know, we're saving CO2 emissions at the same time.
Phil Broadwith. To Cambridge University now, and the electron microscopic equivalent of a CT scan for materials.
Hi, I'm Paul Midgley. I'm a professor of material science here in the Department of Material Science and Metallurgy. And I'm very much involved in research in electron microscopy, and in particular 3D electron microscopy, sometimes known as electron tomography. So basically, an electron microscope is a very powerful microscope which uses electrons rather than light to look at the structure of materials, ranging from metals and semiconductors and polymers, all sorts of different materials. And in particular, it allows us to look at these materials with much better resolution, much better spatial resolution than you can with light. And typically what you do with an electron microscope is you form an image, okay, a sort of two-dimensional image, which is really a projection of a three-dimensional object. So what we've been doing recently is trying to move towards a three-dimensional electron microscopy technique where we take a series of images and use that series of images to form or to reconstruct a three-dimensional object.
Is this effectively the electron microscopic equivalent of CT? As in, that uses X-rays, you're doing this for electrons?
Yeah, very much so. So all forms of tomography are really very similar. We just happen to be using electrons rather than X-rays, but very much like CT. So what we do is we typically have a very small sample in the electron microscope, which we tilt about a single tilt axis and acquire images sort of one by one every 1 or 2 degrees, and then use that ensemble of images to then form a 3D reconstruction. So very much like a CT scan or MRI that people are perhaps are familiar with.
You make it sound really simple, but I presume the fact that you're having to do this and it doesn't yet exist as a mainstream thing, that there must be some flies in this ointment. What are the problems you're having to try and overcome?
Really, there are some key problems. One is that because we're working at very, very small scale, any small shift in the sample as we tilt, we have to correct for. So we have to always worry about sort of image registration once we come back to actually doing the reconstruction. But also with any electron microscopy method, we also have to worry a little bit about electron beam damage. So we're often looking at very small structures, and as we acquire our images, and this might take over perhaps 1, 2, 3 hours in total, if the sample itself starts to damage during that time, then we really have to sort of throw the whole series away and start again. So there's a lot of sort of practical details that we've had to worry about, as well as perhaps the more sort of technical details in how best to get that reconstruction as optimum as possible.
And when the electron beam hits the thing that you're studying, how do you then detect the surface contour or where the various electron fields are in that thing? How do you build the picture?
Right, so there's lots of different imaging modes in electron microscope. The one that we use most is something called scanning transmission electron microscopy. So what we do is we actually focus the beam to a very, very small point, and then raster that over the sample. And actually, our detector is then below the sample. And what we have is an annular detector, typically, which picks up electrons to very high angles. Now, I say very high for electron microscopy is just a few degrees. But these electrons that are scattered to very high angles sort of contain information about the sample, and in particular they're very sensitive to the atomic number of the sample, so we can get images with nice high contrast. So for example, if we're looking at, say, very heavy bimetallic particles on a light silica matrix, then these bimetallic particles stand out very bright. So we end up with images which are high contrast, and which also have the sort of contrast that is particularly good for tomography. And what we really need to have is an image that in some way is an approximation of a projection. And that's one of the sort of criteria for good tomography, is we have a relatively simple image contrast, which we can describe as really a projection.
And what sorts of things are lending themselves to this sort of analysis, or what sorts of questions can you now probe doing this that we couldn't have done with traditional methods?
Yeah, so we got into this whole area really because we were set a sort of challenge, as it were. So we'd been working with some chemists in here in Cambridge, and they had made some very nice catalyst samples, some heterogeneous catalysts, which they were using for lots of their chemical reactions. And these were catalysts which were composed of very small sort of nanoparticles, 1 to 2 nanometer nanoparticles, typically made of platinum or gold or ruthenium, and these sort of heavy elements. And these were located on and within very light porous matrices, so things like silica and carbon and so on. And what they really wanted to know was the distribution of these particles in three dimensions, so that they could use that as, in some sense, a model to understand the catalytic activity. So they really wanted to know the size of these particles, the distribution of these particles, how they were related to the surface and so on. And we thought, well, we can adapt our STEM imaging technique, couple that with tomography, and really try to see these particles in 3D. And so we started with looking at catalysts, and you know, it was very successful in that regard. And then we've since gone on to look at many, many different materials, not just catalysts, but across the whole range of material science.
Are there any substances that you can't image this way?
Oh, gosh. One of the problems with electron microscopy in general is that you need a high vacuum. So if you have wet samples, or if you have samples that perhaps need some sort of gaseous environment, that doesn't lend themselves too much to electron microscopy. But more and more now, people are now thinking about, well, can we actually create a little sort of mini or nano laboratory within the microscope? And so there's now sort of specialist holders where you can have sort of environments in which you put the sample, which are perhaps, you know, aqueous environments or high pressure environments, where you have very thin membranes to protect the vacuum of the microscope, but still keep your sample under the conditions that it wants to be. So I think there's lots of possibilities there. I can see that being an area that will grow and grow over the years to come.
Paul Midgley. Booze now, and before we find out how enzyme-equipped nanoparticles can knock a hangover on the head, we need a snifter of brandy. Neil.
So Manuel Del Valle and his colleagues from the Autonomous University of Barcelona have tried to replace a panel of expert tasters with a more reproducible electronic way. At the moment, you have to test brandy by getting people to taste it, which is a nice job if you can get it, because there isn't really a systematic way of doing it by GC or any other analysis.
So the purists would argue that actually that's the way it's always been done, and it produces absolutely superb brandy, so why do we need to change it?
Experts might argue that, but I wonder how much brandy is wasted, and also by experts who maybe are a bit tired at the end of the day, have tasted too much, or they've got a cold so they can't taste. So if you have an electronic version or a chemical version, then you don't have that problem with tasters getting tired or a bit too drunk.
And I suppose it is quite good for consistency purposes.
Absolutely, because, you know, with all these things, as there's food scares around at the moment, these things do need to be tested and controlled. So what they've developed is a sort of a set of 6 different sensors that sort of sense for different things, and then using very clever data analysis that's been kind of trained by mimicking or being fed the data that the expert panel of tasters has given them, can exactly replicate the difference in the quality of brandy that the tasters gave.
So it's a bit like one of these intuitive models where you feed in the data from a whole lot of humans, what they would think where they faced with this particular set of brandies.
Yeah, and it's not
the
necessarily...
The program learns, and then you feed it some other samples, and it applies the same criteria and says, well, it's got the following things in common, therefore it must taste like this.
Pretty much, yeah. So they've fed in, you know, a different types of brandy. They've obviously got different flavour profiles, different compounds in them giving those flavours, and they group them together into the same groups of sort of good, medium and bad that the expert tasters gave them. And that's maybe not, you know, you could say, well, you know, that's just reflected in the price and the quality and that kind of thing. But a bit more complicated than that is that brandy's aged in wooden barrels. And what some, perhaps unscrupulous, I'm not sure, producers will do is they'll put chips of wood or flakes of wood or bits of bark in with the brandy as well to kind of speed up the aging process so it's exposed to more wood. And then maybe 1 year's aging might taste like 2 years. And you can tell that if you're a very experienced taster, but I'm not, so perhaps I couldn't. Whereas this sort of electronic tongue is able to differentiate between those different types.
How does the electronic tongue work? What is it actually looking for, and how does it do that?
It's not really in the development in the sensors that's the key thing here. They're just sort of metallic nanoparticles conducting polymers and redox sensors that are quite well known. What they've done is, I think it's the data analysis and the sort of algorithms that they've used to group together the data and check everything out and calibrate it against the human sensors. That's the new part. So it's more the data analysis than the actual chemical techniques themselves, I think.
So why stop with brandy? Will we be doing Brooke Bondi, Taifu, tea, coffee? I mean, that's a huge industry, tasting tea and coffee, and wine, of course. So could they then take the same process and apply it to other beverages or other foodstuffs?
I guess they could, but I wonder if one of the things with brandies and spirits is they're relatively pure. They've got, you know, they've got a lot of water, a lot of alcohol, and then a few distinctive flavour compounds that provide a lot of the sort of the key notes that people are after. Whereas I could imagine that tea and wine and coffee might have a lot more going on and be a lot more complicated, so it wouldn't be quite as straightforward to do it. But then, who knows?
Thank you very much, Neil. Well, sticking with the strong stuff, booze. Phil?
Yes, well, scientists in the US and China have invented a way to encapsulate enzymes that will sober up drunken mice when they've given them a bit too much to drink.
And who's done this and why?
Okay, so this is Yunfeng Lu from the University of California in Los Angeles. And really what they're getting at is how to get several different enzymes to work together in a kind of cascade or production line so that the product of one reaction goes straight into the next reaction in the sequence, or if it produces a toxic byproduct, then that gets broken down straight away. So it's really important for those enzymes to be in the same place and so that they can act together, so you don't get stuff diffusing away or having to find another enzyme in a different part of a cell or construct that you're making.
Oh, I see. So in a cell, you would put the enzymes that are part of a molecular pathway or a biochemical pathway all in the same sort of place in a cell so that the output of one enzyme feeds straight into another enzyme, like a production line, so that it minimises the time that things take to diffuse around cells.
Yes, and that's kind of how you see things in a natural biological cell. You have things organised into organelles or into compartmentalised in cells or tethered in specific areas. What this work is doing is sort of aiming to translate that into a kind of biotechnological setting or into looking at creating proto life forms, sort of, you know, artificial cells or whatever, to do, you know, cascades of reactions to make fine chemicals or something like that.
And they've started with a process that breaks down alcohol.
Yes, alcohol oxidase takes ethanol and oxidizes it to acetaldehyde, but that also produces hydrogen peroxide. The hydrogen peroxide is quite toxic in a biological setting. It's going to oxidize quite a lot of things, so you want to break that down. So there's another enzyme called catalase, which will do that. What the group did was take the alcohol oxidase and the catalase. They then tethered the two together using a stretch of DNA, and on the end of that were inhibitors that will bind very tightly to each of the two enzymes, sort of like a hook. You kind of go fishing for the two enzymes, catch them together. Then they had, on the surface of the enzymes, they'd already put chemical groups that will bind into a polymer. So they're acryl oil groups, so they make a sort of acrylate polymer. If you put a few of the other ingredients in the mixture and something to initiate the reaction, something to cross-link it a bit, you end up with a really thin film of polymer all the way around the outside of these two enzymes. You can then warm it up a little bit to take out the DNA and the inhibitors, and you're left with a kind of little parcel that has the two enzymes ready to go.
And do these things really work to break down alcohol?
So what they did to prove the concept is to feed some mice, which I'm sure were having a very good day that day, a load of alcohol. They then went to sleep. They injected half the mice with this enzyme parcel and half of them didn't get it. And the ones that did woke up significantly earlier, they also, their blood alcohol level dropped. You know, there's a possibility of developing this as a treatment for alcohol dependence or, you know, alcoholism generally, or alcohol abuse. But I think the bigger application is to start putting together whole cascades of different enzymes where you can pass the molecular products from one to the next and make really quite complex fine chemicals in just by feeding in very simple things at one end and getting a very complex thing out at the other end, and you can program what you get by which combination of enzymes you put together.
Sounds amazing. What have we got in terms of our trivia this month, Neil?
Well, you might remember from last month we were talking about the Pope who tried to ban chemistry or alchemy back in the Middle Ages.
And well, he didn't ban it. He was pretty canny because Phil, being a Scotsman, he pointed out that there was a fiscal advantage here because the rule was that they had to donate the equivalent amount of money that they'd alleged to have made in gold to the Pope's coffers.
Popes are often canny like that. But and I think we mentioned that we were hoping that the next Pope might be more interested in chemistry. And as it turns out, the newly elected Pope Francis was once a chemical technician. He trained as a chemist. But the thing, our trivial question this month, is what makes the black smoke black and the white smoke white that told the world that the conclave had elected a new pope?
So they've got to make that switch somehow. So a couple of old tyres for the black and a bit of wet straw for the white? I don't know.
Well, once upon a time it was wet straw that produced the white smoke, but it was kind of grey and people got confused. So after the 2005 election, when no one could tell whether it was black or white and it was all a bit confusing, they went and got some pyrotechnic chemistry involved, and to produce the black smoke they now use anthracene, sulfur and potassium perchlorate. And in the white smoke, they use potassium chlorate, lactose and a rosin.
And that's where we must leave it for this month. Thank you to the Chemistry World team, Neil Withers, Phil Broadwith and Patrick Walters, and our guests, Geoffrey Kibbe and Paul Midgley. Production this month was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. The Chemistry World podcast is sponsored by Waters, who are world leaders in innovative analytical science solutions. We'll be back next month with more cutting-edge chemistry. Until then, though, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.